If you want to take part in the Christmas card stream, now is the last chance for your card to arrive in time. Don't delay.
To understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2025. First, I should say my apologies about the previous stream with the Delphica Society had to be cancelled because somehow they got the night wrong. They didn't know that they were supposed to be on. Each year there tends to be one instance of something like that where a stream just, one of the interviews just has to be cancelled. This year it was them. Unfortunate. There we go. Nothing I could have done about it. But now we're here with Henrik from Red Ice. I don't think Henrik or Red Ice need any introduction. As I've said in the tagline, it is an American-Swedish content powerhouse and has been for many years now, much longer than me, actually. I think you started in 2007. But welcome, Henrik.
Thank you.
And yeah. So. Yeah.
Good to be here. Thank you for inviting me. Always a pleasure being on Millennial. I just want to get that, you know, cleared off the bat here.
I think it's a nice thing at the end of the year for people yes. to do. I think it's nice to have this get together at the end of the year in the cold winter. All right. So, what kind of year do you think 2025 has been?
A good year. A lot of good things.
I think so too. I think so too. For in terms of politics and events, I'm glad that you've said that. So take it away.
Well, I mean, look at the narrative shifting. We talk about this, of course, all the time on the show right now. But it has to be recognized that, like, you know, things that we were talking about in the alt-right days of 2015, 16, 17 is basically being pushed by a lot of, you know, far more normie conservative account. You can, you know, that can be hit and miss, of course, sometimes, but still, I mean, even as many of the faults that we have with Trump, and this is not an endorsement of him for the sake of other things that he does or whatever, but it's, I think it's good to see ICE rounding up illegal migrants. I think it's fun to see. I might not even trust the incentives or the reason why they do it, but to see the Department of Homeland Security, you know, doing tweets like all we want for, you know, Christmas is re-migration and, like, you know, deport, save the West or whatever kind of thing. And it could be underhanded tactic because it could be to make whites complacent. It's to kind of maybe make us seem that they got this, you know, in the bag or whatever. But in a way, it matters and it should be discussed, but it should be recognized still that if that is the case, then it's the reality of that is that then they're forced to respond to the increasing trends of these, you know, let's be honest, for a while, very, very fringe ideas. Fringe where we were censored over, banned, and some of us still are, of course, which is, makes it kind of an interesting dynamic to be in when, like, the Department of Homeland Security can do a tweet like they have to go back. And I remember in 2017 or 8, maybe it was 18, we made a t-shirt for Red Ice that said they have to go back. And we were banned from, it was under Lana's Llama, her kind of clothing account, but they're doing the merch for Red Ice. And the payment processor shut her down. Even the merch website, I think it was, approached her and said, you have to take this product down or we can't do business with you, you know, things like that. So anyway, being that what it is, that was the environment at that time. But now it's like from the halls of power, these messages are being pushed out, right? And that's a good thing. That doesn't mean we're happy here. And it's like, oh, all right, folks, we're done then. Everything is obviously not. Now it goes from saying it to doing it. Now it goes from noticing to doing and fixing, right? So that's kind of the next stage in the evolution of the message of taking our countries back, remigrating all these people that should never have been coming into our countries and so forth. The hard work really kind of begins now. Now it's like, I'm not saying it's culturally acceptable, and of course there's a lot of people still fighting it, and there could be, we'll see what happens, right, with whether it's kind of more populist right-wing parties in Europe that adopts these talking points. Maybe they even start pushing some other policy, but on this regard, obviously, America is kind of at the forefront with the Trump administration for these kinds of issues. Other issues they're doing are horrible and awful, and there's other, you know, censorship on other levels when it comes to like anti-Semitism, supposedly, and things like this, right? So there's not all good things, obviously, but still, it's a response to an increasing trend, which I think is grassroots. It's from the people, it's from bottom up, and like, I think there's people genuinely in the chain of command there that kind of see that, like, yeah, we have to do something about this. I mean, I think it was the U.S. State Department recently, and kind of co-joined with Trump saying some words about it too. But they're basically like telling Europe, like, look, you're like in an existential battle for, you know, the survival of your civilization. You got to deal with migration, or like it's over, because this is ultimately still a security partner for America. And again, it might be for self-serving purposes then, and all, you know, all kinds of possibilities of what the reasons are why they do this. But again, I think I'll go back to the point. That means it's kind of acceptable in politics to talk about these things now. So of course, next step is to, you know, act on the ideas, actually doing policy that inflicts these changes, organizing, activism, building community. Like, there's so many things that comes in the wake of this, forming institutions that actually stands up for white people. And I think we have it's hard to say exactly, but maybe, I don't know, what, 10 years maybe? Maybe we have a decade window, maybe slightly longer, maybe slightly less, depending on how you view it, before it's increasingly impossible to do something about it. So I think this is crunch time. I think we have been on the clock for a long time, but now it's like, it's do or die. It's like white identity or extinction. And I think this is becoming clear. So now you have all these voices. They're at least on the surface. They're anti-white, right? Like, you know, Matt Walsh can talk about this now. There's the J.D. Vance, you know, like, you know, they talk about these things, about how DEI has been a campaign against white men and, you know, things like that. So that's like, they got that covered now. You know what I mean? Doesn't mean they're necessarily the best people to represent those things, but I'm saying let them push that. Let them continue to do that. That's fine. But then think about the next stage of this, right? Form an institution that can actually defend white people. Start operating in such a capacity that we can actually fight back on an equal playing field when it comes to these other, you know, civil rights or type organization, human rights organizations, maybe NGOs. There's so many, we've been bouncing around with so many ideas, and there's already groups doing this, I should say too, which is a very positive sign, right? Whether it's a, you know, kind of an idea like the Return to the Land or something, or the Woodlander Initiative in the UK, or, you know, things like that. And it's moving, right? They're getting more members. People are interested in this. And then you have White Papers Policy Institute and things like that. They're kind of in that vein, right, of like beginning to form institutions that can actually stand up for our people, which is great. So yeah, overall, I'm positive. It's moving in the right direction. It's maybe not, as we always feel, that this is a sense of urgency. Maybe it's not moving fast enough for us. It's got to happen tomorrow, kind of thing, or yesterday, I guess, preferably. There's a fighting chance here. There's a window. We're gonna have to do this. We're gonna have to pull this off, and it's inevitable. That's how I view it. This is inevitable, and it's going to happen. It's just a matter of how long it's gonna take and how painful it's gonna be. And the sooner we kind of just get that mind space, they're like, all right, we have to do it, and it's up to us, right? Even though someone says it from the White House, whatever, doesn't mean that they're going to fix it for us, but it means that it's culturally acceptable to like really engage in these ideas. So I'm very positive anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this has been a great year, and for all these reasons that you've listed there, I'm not going to go into each one, but I will say I think the key point is that now they're talking about remigration. Now that the politicians. That now makes it the baseline. So it's not any longer, are there too many of them? Are there too many illegals? Is there a country? Is there a unit? Is there anything? Is there even American culture? That's the bollocks, the nonsense that we've had to contend with for the last 10, 15, 20 years, in your case. Whereas now the baseline is, How are we going to remigrate them? How many of them? When? And that, so that advances things because, well, and I know people will say, well, they can say anything. It doesn't mean anything. But the point is they are now saying this. So now we can hold them to account for this. If they fail to remigrate a lot, then we can hold them to account for that. Rather than still be at the stage where we're trying to get them to even recognize that there is a thing to protect in the United States or Sweden or France or Germany or England or Scotland. But of course, in those countries, it's a different situation. And that's part of it, that this contrast with America and the United States and everywhere else, including Canada. Of course, Justin Trudeau admitted that this mistake happened and we somehow let in millions of people live, too many. Let's not get into that. My point is that it seems almost like this happened by accident. The regime that we knew for many, many years wouldn't have wanted Trump in power. But for whatever reason it happened, I think because of Israel and October 7th and all that, but whatever, it happened. And now he is, and J.D. Vance, are diametrically opposed to the thinking in Europe. But they're more powerful than Europe. They're more powerful than European countries. So I wonder what's going on now. Are we talking about two different elites or at least two different fronts for elites? And is one of them going to persuade the other one, the Europeans, to do the same thing? Or are the Europeans going to just dig in and resist, you know, Trump derangement syndrome, Vance derangement syndrome, resist the calls to remigration? Because after all, this is what they've been saying about Trump all these years, that he's a crazy racist. So what do you predict there? I mean, you can talk about the different European countries in as much detail as you want, because I think this will be interesting.
Yeah, there's like multiple strands at the same time kind of going on. It's true that they've tried to make, you know, Europe more kind of aligned, obviously, on American values. You know, it's always been, this is a history that goes way back, right, to the Marshall Fund, and you could even argue the Monroe Doctrine, you know, before that. But then it's, you know, everything we learned with USAID. But these are prior administrations, right? That's not Trump that was behind that. But you kind of have to see, you can't just take like the Trump administration and say, well, that's you know, America. You have to take, you know, consecutive and many administrations into account. What's the whole of the picture? And of course, it seems to be, again, even if it's for the wrong reason, that it's a right turn even for Europe, that they're criticizing them for what they're doing. At the same time, it should be recognized that even the things such as the European Union wasn't invented by America, but it was certainly promoted by America at the time when Henry Kissinger was, head of the State Department, for example. It was like, who do I talk to if I need to talk to Europe, right? There was these like kind of ideas that we should just federalize Europe and it's easier to deal with them. So it's this weird kind of relationship between the officials of America and Europe, right? The foreign policy stance that America, you know, has had against Europe, which is keep them dependent, right? Keep them weak enough so they don't challenge America, but keep them strong enough so they can also be an ally when it comes to like NATO and, you know, all these kinds of things, right? But kind of through like USAID and other such programs, like through the back door, we got like as stay behind armies and NATO claim that they're helping to fight communism, you know, from taking hold in Europe. Cultural Marxism comes in through the back door with like, you know, and now USAID is funding tranny theaters in Macedonia or whatever the hell, you know, all these crazy things that we learned about. So it's not as easy to say, it's just like, well, you know, America's an enemy of Europe, or Europe is, you know, doesn't want to cooperate with America. It's a very complex, dynamic situation. But what it should be, I can say that, what it should be is that America and Europe should be on good terms. We should have leadership that looks after the people, and we should be united, including with Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, like any country that was built by white people, obviously, right? We should be united. We should have a glorious future. We can have a white passport, right, throughout the white world, whatever white country you can travel and go to, and we have a good relationship. We have a trade bloc together. We operate as a unit and as a powerful force to, you know, be able to geopolitically compete with, be that China or India or, you know, whatever other region it is, essentially. But so we'll see if any of that comes out of it. But okay, so going back to the point, it feels a little bit like the type of populism or right-wing kind of factions in Europe that has maybe not allowed. I mean, if you look at Germany, I mean, they are fighting hard to try to shut down the AfD, potentially try to ban it. It's true. And for all the criticisms we can have and should have with them, that they're not strong enough and all these things, right? It's been this interesting shift where they're kind of seeking to align right-wing policies and right-wing political parties with basically a pro-Zionist stance, right? Many European countries have had, you know, left-wing socialist policies. It was like, you know, kind of the Palestinians are the underdogs or whatever. And with that, you get a bunch of the migration stuff or whatever. But now after October 7th, what was that interesting dynamic where, like, some of them acted shocked that there was, like, thousands and thousands of like Muslims or whatever other nons out protesting against Israel for Palestine. And, you know, like Germany's trying to crack down on the protest. In the UK, they did the same. They're trying to ban Palestine Action, or they have, right, more or less. So it's...
Yes, they have.
They have, right, yeah. So it's an interesting dynamic there of where they're trying to kind of align, I guess, like if you're standing up for Western values, then you're like, you're with the Zionist cause, you know, kind of thing. So I see that that dynamic is happening at the same time. So they're like kind of letting them go in that way. It's the same with the Sweden Democrats and the Vox Party in Spain. What was the third party? There was one more. Maybe it was the AfD, actually. They were kind of entering into like official ties with Israel recently. And they went to like a trip down to Israel. And many of these party heads were very happy about this, obviously. Like, yes, we're finally in, you know, kind of thing. So there's like there's a potential of kind of like trying to derail the trajectory or make this rather about like being supportive of Zionism or something. And that's the foot in through the door for them. However, again, it's still a dangerous game for them to play because it still is kind of opening the door to like making nationalism okay again. Right. So it's all about like, OK, which direction do we want to go? Well, as long as it's a nationalism, we actually stand up for ourselves and don't make it about another country or making it about supporting, you know, this political group or this other ethnic group or whatever it is, then it's fine. And it can come at the hands of anyone. But we have to watch out, essentially, make sure that these are actually interests that are ultimately good for us and that it's about Europeans and the European people and not for some other ulterior motive or something like that. So. Yeah, I don't know. I still think it's positive, right? You're seeing remigration proposals in many countries. Sweden recently kind of initiated a program where they're offering migrants money to return, and you've seen these types of things. And it's not that's like that's ideal, and people can be like, "Well, we shouldn't be paying money to get these people to leave." And I agree. But that's not what it's about. Look at how the left operated for many, many decades, right? It was like you get a small win, and now that's become established reality. You get another small win, and you gain territory slowly but surely. And we're kind of seeing that in a rightward, more nationalistic direction now. We're having small wins that in and of itself doesn't mean much, but as long as we keep pushing, and collectively we're saying we're not happy with this. We need more. We must have more, and it must continue to happen. They're on the retreat, right?
Yeah, and that was how the left always worked. I remember when Civic Partnerships came in the early 2000s and in Britain, and they all said, of course, this isn't a step towards gay marriage. That would be ridiculous. Nobody wants to change marriage. And then less than 10 years later, gay marriage.
So we're just like, no, this is not about fascism.
Yeah.
Of course it's not.
No, it's... This is a...
It's not about ethno-nationalism, no.
Yeah. This is how the left always operated. And usually they were more explicit than that. I mean, they would just say, yeah, okay, we've got this, but there's still so much more to go. We've got this, but this isn't enough. They were not happy with this. And it was always this driving force. And first of all, I think it's interesting that driving force seems to have kind of dried up. I think that's very interesting.
Yeah.
But also, it's important to say that right-wingers now have to try to develop that same attitude. And I think it doesn't come naturally to them at all. I mean, we'll get to the murder of Charlie Kirk later on, but I'll say for now, that didn't last long. The outrage should have gone. Yeah. I mean, look what happened with George Floyd, for God's sake. And I know that was top down. Maybe that's the key difference. Maybe the left are actually as sleepy as the right. It's just that things are made to happen from a high level. I don't know.
They have a lot of help.
I think it's both. I think that the left mentality is just, if you can talk about such a thing, is more hysterical and more demanding and more self-assured. You can see this just by talking to them in real life compared to your average conservative who's,
They're fanatical. They're dedicated. Yeah. They've weaponized the spiteful mutants, essentially, and they're doing it very effectively. I mean, sure, yeah, they have billionaires funding some of these things, obviously, to actually happen. But on the street, you get the freaks and the mutants out and to, just create chaos and havoc or whatnot. I think it's really about just getting the con ink, like the older, the boomer conservative types, just quit, just move aside. And let people actually understand the reality on the ground of how bad things actually are in some of our, not just big cities now, it's everywhere. But I'm saying like they actually understands this. And that's why I think they have a totally different, this is not about some, nominal, economic, tax rate or some, that train has left the station a long time ago. And now this is an existential fight. And I think, therefore, for some, I'm not saying that the left still have power. They're still, but the air has just kind of gone out of it, right? And partially it was when the woke bubble popped. I always kind of saw it as a psyop woke. It was almost like this: you make it so radical and so crazy that you basically just put, when you finally pop that bubble and back up, you're still, you've taken 100 steps forward, 2, 3, 5, maybe steps back when woke popped or whatever. And then you're still in a very far left environment, but it feels kind of more normal because at least the crazy woke stuff isn't there. But having said that, I still see the main momentum is in the more radical right wing, if you will, or nationalistic individuals and organizations. That's where the energy is for sure. I mean, because how can you push any of these left-wing ideas now, today, with everything, and think that this is somehow going to... I mean, it's not that they're not going to fight back, right? Take America, then, as an example, because, kind of the Trump administration has been on the forefront. They're pushing with the ICE deportations, the optics of this, right? That kind of an interesting dynamic, too, that we know it's not fast enough, we know it's not strong enough, and they are legally restricted. There's certain things they just can't do that everyone kind of wished that they could do, essentially. But it's also kind of like catnip for the liberals that they're seeing this. And the argument is like, this is fights, Nazism is back. Oh, my God, kind of thing. So if they do get in 2020, 28. That's right. That's the next election cycle. 28 or 32, whenever it happens to be that they do come in and get power. Are you going to see pushback? Yeah, hell yeah. It's going to be crazier pushback than we've ever seen before. However, then they simply radicalize, and so does the other side. And it just the swings of the pendulum just goes deeper and longer as everything, as we go. And that's kind of just the nature of the game. It's basically who can play that the best and who can persevere. We might not have to win every battle, but we have to win the war, as I say. And that's really where it comes down to. And so yes, will there be a pushback? Yes, I call it the brown lash, right, to use Van Jones's term after the first Trump election, right, on CNN there. He called it a white lash. But yes, we're going to see a brown lash now when our, white kids in America are already a minority now. They're like around 40%, I think, or something like that. And you could very, very, very well see a bunch of like a left brown green alliance being totally weaponized and just brutal against the white minority now. And that's a possible trajectory,
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I think what's interesting about that is that there is no place in that alliance for white liberals, for white progressives.
Not really,
Some of them could be there as stragglers, but they're not going to be, it's not going to be their thing anymore. It's not going to be their party anymore. It's going to belong to the minority, and it's going to be dominated by the minorities that they've brought in, or, well, they've cheered being brought in to these countries. So that's interesting, because I wonder, will that mean that these white liberals just join our side, because there's no place for them on the left anymore?
Yeah, good question. I don't think we need them, but as we know, there is power in numbers, and we do have to have the numbers, and I think we should be suspicious of welcoming some of them. But yeah, there's plenty of people that have rolled around, and again, that's not something I'm kind of losing sleep over at night or anything, or wondering, you know, will the liberals come over? You know,
kind of, no, neither am I.
That's not what I'm saying. No, I'm not saying you're saying that, but yeah. But it's like,
it just occurred to me.
But yeah, I mean, but yeah, some of them probably will, because this is about identity too. It is actually about them feeling that they're belonging somewhere. Where's my clique? Where's my club? Where's my you know, thing that I get initiated into, and it's a, you know, just for us, you know, kind of thing.
Where can I be a good person? Where will I get told that I'm a fucking lovely person? And yeah, it's not going to be on the left anymore. That's the thing. I mean, if these are people who are desperately seeking virtue points, they're not going to get them on the left.
No,
I mean,
it's
an interest. This only just occurred to me just now, so this isn't some theory that I've got a lot of faith in. It's just an interesting idea that if there is no place for them on the left, what are they going to do? They might just become apolitical,
or suicide bombers
for the cause. Well. Yeah. Okay, if you won't take me, then I'll kill myself for you.
Exactly. I don't, who knows?
You'll have to take me
there. Because let's be honest, a lot of them, even if they wanted to join, we shouldn't let them. We don't want them to. Anyway, I get your point. We'll see what happens. It's an interesting dynamic. But yeah, I mean, undoubtedly, as they say, your skin color is your immutable, you know, characteristics. It's your military outfit. It's your costume. It's what you can't take it off. Some people have tried, but, you know, it's not very successful, and very handful of them have done that. But join us or die, right? Join us or be targeted and go extinct. That's kind of really where that's the line in the sand, you know?
Yeah. It's going to get that stark. And that reminds me of Tucker Carlson, and he's recently... We'll talk about his stuff throughout this year, but recently he's reverted to this nonsense about I don't want to be judged by my race, and I don't think it's right to judge anyone by their race, and this kind of ridiculous 60s stuff, the MLK stuff. It's weird. He's too young to be like that. You know, that's boomer talk, and he's too young for that, and so I think he knows what he's doing. But let's go through the events of this year for America, just four major events, and we don't need to go on at huge length about them, but I want to hear your perspective. I should have done this. I did do this with Jared Taylor sort of by accident. I'm going to do it properly with you in chronological order.
Mm-hmm.
There are four things. Austin, it starts with Austin Metcalf, because it seems to me that these four events have kind of form the narrative of America in 2025 and explain how we got from where we were in January to where we are now in December. So it starts with Austin Metcalf. What would you say about that incident and the effects that it had?
Yeah, what date was that? Was that early in the year? I'm trying to remember. And if you don't have it, that's fine. I'm just trying to think of like how quickly kind of it escalated, because
it was the 2nd of April.
Okay, so kind of early in the year. Okay. Well, what I would say about it, it's that it's obviously, as we know, just one link in a long chain of these types of attacks, these types of anti-white, you know, murders, and just openly. And so it's not that the events happened and then white people started reacting. It's that white people are finally, for some reason, beginning to notice them. It's finally getting out, right? I mean, the outrage around Cannon Hinnan, it was still kind of sizable, but it wasn't as much maybe as Metcalf, for example, right? And there's many other cases before that. Some if I knew we were going to talk about this, maybe I should rattle some of them off, the names or whatever. But like, you can go back to like, you know, you know, nationalists in Sweden being murdered or, you know, something like that, right? Going back to like the 2000s, 90s even. But it's the momentum of the attention on them. For some reason, it's just this collective kind of buildup of like of noticing or the fatigue or whatever that has like been building. And I mean, specific about the case, I mean, it's not really, but what can I say? This is just an average day for a white kid in America around these people. That's really what it is. That's not really, unfortunately, that's not the extraordinary thing. The extraordinary thing, thankfully, is that as these cases have continued to happen, finally, we've got a kind of like a release. This is just not some like fringe website that does nothing but cover black on white crime, you know, like the Daily Ken or something, you know, something like that. That we just like, you can go there and just like, oh, another white person, you know, every day there's something, right? And it's like, yeah, we know, right? So how do we change our mentality? How do we change our collective, attitude towards this, right?
I think what was unique or unprecedented about this incident was the GiveSend or the whatever it was.
GoFundMe, oh, sure, yeah,
was set up,
yeah,
mm-hmm, and yeah. I think they made $500,000 or something like that from black people eagerly supporting this guy who'd obviously just murdered a young man, and it was all. I mean, I should say allegedly, but you know, everyone can have their opinion about what happened. We all roughly know what happened.
Yeah.
And it seems either way that Black America definitely had an opinion about it, and that was that they should support the black guy. And they and I think a lot of white people saw that and were kind of shocked. And Jared Taylor mentioned what this happened in the 90s, in 95, with the OJ trial. But, well, yeah, it did, but the reaction was not the same. I mean, there's something happened.
Right.
It seems to me from across the Atlantic, something happened in America, in white America, seeing this reaction from black people. And then there was his Austin Metcalf's
Just came to me as we're talking, the dad's reaction. Exactly. Yeah. That was a shocker.
Which, oh my gosh. It was like, if white people wanted a lesson in, yeah, if they wanted their instincts confirmed, that would have confirmed them. This guy tried to cozy up to the killer of his son and his family, and I think he attended church service or something.
Yeah.
And they tried to kick him out. What are you doing there? What on earth are you doing? It's like the behavior of a crazy person, what he was doing. And maybe he was crazy with grief, bereavement. But either way, he tried to cozy up to these black people who had wronged him, who had killed his son, and they rejected him. They punished him further. They humiliated him further. I remember him saying, I've just forgotten this until now. He said, the kid who did this, I've already forgiven him.
Yep.
I remember. Already. Yep. Yes. Yep. Already.
Because that's what he's supposed to do, right? He's older. He's boomer age, right? I mean, that's what his culture, his religion. I mean, he brought that up, right? No, God tells, you know, God says we should forgive these people, you know, and it's just a different, it's a different mentality. It's a dying mentality. And it doesn't, he might actually really have believed it also, though. That this is hard. We're not in the head of his father, but he probably really believed it, right? Really, this is the good thing to, you know, the right thing to do. Because I don't think, I guess if you're crazy, you would try to score points or like be the, you know, I'm going to be the bigger man here or something, the better person by saying, yeah, forgive the killer. You know, and we've seen a lot of that. We've seen cases like that in the UK. But I'm saying that's like, that just radicalizes the whites even more, actually, when they see that. And so part of me is like kind of like, yeah, okay, I like good, I guess. He's like, we'll take it, I guess. To show that how totally skewed the dynamic is. And even when whites, to their utmost, try to bridge the gap and try to make this, you know, as he said, right? Oh, it's not about race, blah, blah, blah. And the blacks were like, fuck you, white man, essentially, right? They were just like, we don't have nothing to do with you. And it's a slap in the face, you know, but like a lot of people out there, a lot of white people see this and they're just like, yeah, well, okay, well, there you go, right? What can we do then? Right?
Exactly.
So,
and
good.
That brings us. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's like mask off. It's
yeah.
Clarifies, simplifies everything. It's great. And that's why I think a month later, and this brings us to the second event, Shiloh Hendricks. What would you say about that? Because I think that's just the direct result of the Austin Metcalf follow.
Yeah, exactly. It was because you had the fundraiser on the other side, and now you had a kind of a flip on that, and now white people could come in and you know support her financially, which was just you know incredible the support. Right? It was just it was insane. I think there was like it was a watershed moment. It was like we crossed the Rubicon in terms of like whites just like finally have had enough of sorts. I mean, it's never really down to one thing like that, but. But there's a, as you said, that's obviously why you're bringing these up too. But there's a few of those moments that have happened now in 2025 that really pushed a lot of whites like over that edge finally, where they're just like, all right, we're done. And so that was a great the timing of it. Just the beams of the universe just aligned, you know, around Shiloh Hendricks at that point, and it was beautiful. And she turned out to be you know our gal, right? She was you know. Tom Hennessy and a bunch of other people too helped her out, and Tom has been in contact with him. I've talked to Tom; he's a great guy, and you know, I'm glad he set that up for her or whatever. And that was probably his most you know successful you know kind of way that he helped to pull all that together. So yeah, what can I say? Fantastic! It was great. But again, notice though, the other guy fundraised off of murder. This was off of word, so it's still an imbalance. Do you see what I'm saying? It's still not. We're not there yet.
Yeah, no. Yeah, definitely. But I think things like that are great. I mean, you can. I know some people didn't like that. You know, she wasn't the most perfect. She used crass language and all that. She wasn't the perfect avatar for white nationalism. Sure, I don't. But the point is that. An event like that builds morale and momentum, and it teaches, it's us teaching ourselves, learning the lesson that we can actually do things, and that when the liberals, the progressives come for us, we don't need to just be victims.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'll always remember when I got doxxed, I can't remember how long this took. It was about, I think the first 2 days were sort of terrifying. And then, two big videos were made in my defense by Black Pigeon Speaks and Lauren Southern. And say what you like about Lauren Southern, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant to this story. The point is that I suddenly realized, holy shit, like, the two of them combined have got more viewers than these newspapers have readers. And, you know, it's not concentrated in one place like the papers are, but still. The point is, I realize we can actually fight back. And that was a great moment for me. It was, yeah. And I think that similarly, the Shiloh Hendricks thing was a similar thing for white people in general, especially in America. They learned the lesson that, well, we can make her rich.
Yeah.
It doesn't cost that much. It's like $5 each or something. And she doesn't need to worry about being unemployed, being unemployable, having bills to pay, the authorities coming after her. She's covered. She's covered for the rest of her life. And it doesn't cost that many people much at all. As I say, $5, $10. And what that means is, okay, we're actually powerful. We're actually strong.
Yeah, and it also means that power that they had over taking out the camera to film another white Karen or you know whatever the argument is, to weaponize that, to ruin someone's life. In other words, the fear of not being able to express or say what you want. That's why it's perfect. And I don't, obviously have no problem with Shy. I don't care that she used profanities or whatever. She had some tats or whatever. But like, no, but that's what is makes it perfect. Because if whites would have waited to sit around to wait for the perfect candidate for something like this, we would have waited forever. And so the point is just go all in. It doesn't matter. You have to think like the other side does. There's Jeets.
They defended George Floyd.
I mean, well, exactly. They defend killers, the worst of them, right? And so, and we just have to play that game. You don't, you know, some people can disagree or they might not like it or whatever. The point is you stand up for her because she's white and she's in trouble. That's really just what it boils down to. It doesn't matter what she said or how uncouth she was or something was wrong with this or that, you know.
To be clear, I don't care about any of that. I'm just saying
people,
I saw some people doing the usual thing, which is looking for a reason not to support this cause.
Right.
Well, yeah. What flaws can I find with the person so that I don't have to take part
help
in
out.
This?
Yeah.
And help out. And it's always annoying because there's always a reason. There's always something that you can find.
Yeah.
But then everyone, including you, learns the lesson that we're fucking weak.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And I don't think that's good for us. So I think that this was terrific because, as I say, it was the beginning of agency for I don't know if it was the beginning. I'm not going to be that presumptuous, but you get what I mean. The sense of agency in white America. It was good to watch from across the pond.
it's really if it was one thing or one slogan, right? It was the end of white guilt. That's kind of what that's the watermark that it hit. If that makes sense. And there's been cases before and after, as we know as well. But it's like, it shows that it's like, okay, we're collectively kind of finally getting it right. It's happening, which is good.
And we're going to collectivize when one of us is targeted. The rest of us are going to help out, and it costs each of us nothing, really, nothing, $5, whatever. And it has a huge effect collectively. And this is the whole thing that you and I have and many others have been trying to spread for ages, for years, this idea that the collective works. It's extremely powerful, far more powerful than individuals operating separately.
I want to say one more thing about it there too. Obviously it's just the beginning, right? Because ideally what you want to have here then is not that, and it's not because we shouldn't have a problem to chip in 5, 10, 20, 100 bucks or whatever to help her out or anyone like her at that point. That's not what it's about either. However, I'll say this. When we start noticing, when we're going to start noticing a real change and difference is when we have our own organizations set up to lead a press conference. Like, look at how some of these other groups react, right? There's an organization with funds there. And they're receiving federal grant money, right? Which is ultimately kind of our own money, if you will. But still, you see what I'm saying? Where you are so powerful in a sense that you don't just, you know, take collectively from us to help someone out, but a whole organization that's just there, be that an NGO or a kind of a civil rights organization for white people or a European Cultural Fund or helping display. I mean, there's all these things that are a rabbit hole, deep dive, not super deep dive, but like rattling through a couple of things that, for example, some of these Jewish groups have. And it started with the situation in Kentucky with this anti-white teacher that we're basically talking about how kids got to be feel bad because they're, you know, they have white skin, basically. And I saw that she had worked for a time at the, I think it was
that evil woman. Is that that awful old woman?
Sarah Stalker.
Let me see.
There's so many of them, obviously. And they're still there. They haven't gone away, obviously, as we know. But yeah, Sarah Stalker, that's the case I was talking about. But anyway, long story short, I noticed that she had.
Not her.
Okay, it's some other one. Yeah. I noticed that she had, you know, worked at the, a Jewish daycare for a while. And I just started Googling about this one Jewish group in Kentucky. And anyway, long story short, let me down this just path of this.
I was thinking of Jane Elliott, this evil.
Oh, that's way back. The blue eyes, brown eyes test thing. No, that's fine. No, that was this was recently, very like just a couple of weeks ago, a week ago, or something like that. Anyway, point is, it led me to this just briefly looking up. Oh, okay, so they have a community center there in Kentucky, this Jewish group or whatever. And it's like, okay, I'm just scroll down to the footer and I found some, I forget the names of them now because there's so many. There's literally tens of thousands of these groups now. But it was something about some Jewish federal fund or something. And then I was searching, how did they make their money? Kind of thing. Oh, it's donations and it's some other means here and there. They get money. And then, but they get it from the American Jewish Distribution Committee or something. And I look at them and like, how do they make their money or whatever. Anyway, it led me down to this path where like, Oh, there's an American Jewish Association for committee distribution funds that have their headquarters in Jerusalem, but they're receiving American federal taxpayer money, which means, you know, for now, primarily white people, because whites are still a majority in America for now. It's, you know, when the boomers go, that change.
Being the majority of the tax.
Yeah, exactly. So it comes out of our pockets, but there's this one group and other groups that they have are interlinked, and there's an NGO over here. There's a body for human rights, something, or Jewish causes over here. There's cross funding. And I'm sure there's, like, if we had our shit together, we would have our own ADL that can investigate these organizations and find illegality. They do placements of some of them are run as a nonprofit and a charity, but they have endowment funds. They invest in the stock market to grow the portfolio of the money that comes in from federal grants, and they're moving things around. They're operating under 10, 15 different names. And it was like some organization to help children who are, in a tight spot, essentially. I forget the terms of them now, but the point is, it was like a myriad of groups and organizations set up, but it basically boils down at the end of it that the majority of the funding they get is federal grants, right, from the U.S. federal government, essentially, which is taxpayers, right? So that's really, we need to get in. That was my argument at the time. We need to get into that game. We can't just sit on the sidelines and oh, here's another white woman that said the N-word on somewhere. And again, it's as much fun as that is, and as important that is, just to throw off the shackles of us being limited, even in the words that we use. These are very symbolically important events to say, basically, F you, you don't have any power over us anymore. And if one of us ends up in trouble, as you said, we will help each other out and we'll sort this out. But of course, that's not the end goal. That's not the purpose. That's not the end goal, right? That's just to liberate ourselves from being able to use the words that we can to accurately express what's happening to us. But we need institutions and groups to help our own. This needs to be established foundations and, you know, NGO, whatever it is, something that's like there as a base level protector for people who are white, who ends up in that situation, even to begin with. That's what I'd say.
I completely agree. It needs to be an infrastructure for white well-being, for white protection in America. And the thing about foundations and institutions is that they are long-running, so they develop expertise and experience of dealing. So it's not like they're having to deal with this thing that's happened 100 times before, but they're having to deal with it for the first time, so they don't know what they're doing. It shouldn't be like that. It doesn't need to be like that. There can be institutions that persist and get better and better and better with time.
It's about learning that world.
Any other group would do this.
Yeah, it's about learning that. Can we get, so instead of saying, I'm saying instead of fundraising, I'm not saying we shouldn't have fundraised, but let's assume that we're at a point where we had our shit together to such an extent that we knew that there were some capable people. And we could do a fundraiser like that raises $2-3 million or whatever it is, right? And their job is basically just to, like, begin the process of, like, hiring a full-time staff that with knowledgeable people that understand this world. They can, you know, maybe they've studied civics or, like, how do you run NGOs, whatever it is. I hope we have people with that expertise. So if we don't, well, then we have to pay for the education for some of our younger people that can kind of gray man it, get into that world, and hopefully within 5-10 years, we have those people. I think we do have some of those people, but still, pay them a good salary to get into that world of just investigate all the little. There's websites in the U.S. This is true for, like, European countries. So I'm not just talking about America here, but for the case of America in this example, that you can find where are there kind of holes in the available grant. There's the federal government sitting there, like, waiting for someone to take this money, right, to do this one thing. And again, I'm not saying illegality. I'm not saying doing it. I'm just saying we should have the fortitude and the agency where we now form a group and an organization and an NGO, whatever it is, that can fill that space, that starts taking federal U.S. money to, one, yes, fulfill the task that you're expected to do, whatever it is. Hopefully it's something that benefits us also. But even if it's not, do the job. Put our guys in there. Let our people do that. But then there's profit from that. These people can get a good salary. That money can be shuffled over to another group or institution. They can help and you know, work to the benefit of our people in other capacities in that world, if you will. There's so many untapped potential. And this is not for everyone. I know that some people say, oh, gosh, you're like, we got to go. No, we should just all, you know, stop paying taxes or something kind of thing. I was like, oh, okay, sure. If everyone did that at once, it would literally be a very powerful thing. But that's not going to happen. Let's be realistic. People have lives and they have kids and they have jobs and they have mortgages and they're invested and they have a fit. They just can't stop. Like, it's not going to happen. So like it or not, we're going to have to operate within this world for as long as we can. Right. And we're just late to the game. Indians come in and they do it. They take advantage of this. Sure, they might have some help and they have lawyers and attorneys from maybe SPLC that helps them out, or ADL or some other group, right? But they are effective in organizing. Heck, they're building like monkey statues all over US and Canada right now, you know, for example. Like how do they do this? They're so low IQ, but I mean, again, they might be getting help, but they're very good and effective at organizing. And I'm sure they're getting help to get the federal, you know, grants to raise the, you know, to have the funds to build a statue. And, you know, we know all these things, but part of us, I'm not saying everyone has to do this, but some of us are going to have to bite the bullet and say, okay, I work at a job that sucks anyway or whatever. Okay, wouldn't you rather work for like a foundation or an institution or an NGO then that maybe pays you better than the job that you currently do, but you've educated yourself or we've helped to pay for an education for you to understand that world and be in that environment. Now you're in a position where maybe you can start handing out federal grant money to white families in need or something like that. That's literally like funneled money through the federal government to these families that need help or whatever it might be. I'm just throwing out some ideas here, but I'm saying there's a whole untapped world there that most of us, I know some people are doing this, I'm not saying I'm unique in looking at this, but I'm saying most of us are just not thinking in those terms at all.
Yeah,
we're just sitting on the sidelines and wanting to just kind of jump out of the system and think we're going to fix it somehow, right? And you know, I don't know. I just
any other group would be doing this, and in fact all other groups are doing this to whatever extent they can. I mean, the Indians are obviously collectivizing, they're backing each other up, they're working together. What they're not doing is trolling each other, falling out with each other, backbiting each other in the way that white people tend to do. They're actually just getting things done, and unfortunately that means to the detriment of white Americans and Canadians. Everywhere. So this is the thing that white people really need to learn, because I think as long as we continue operating purely as individuals and decrying any sort of group activity on behalf of us as a group, we're just going to get eaten alive. And as I say, the Shiloh thing really seemed to show the beginning of the end of that mentality. I think it lives in Con Inc. and in the boomers. I think Con Inc. basically exists to maintain that mentality, to prevent white America from seeing itself as a collective. And I just hope to see the end of these things. I mean, the boomers are obviously not going to live forever, and I don't like saying that because I have some of my best friends are boomers.
We're going to miss them when they're gone. I tell you, as much critique we have of the boomers, like demographically, it's going to be a totally different landscape when the boomers are gone. You know what I mean? Like we'll be numerical minority at that point, and it will be who knows what is happening at that point.
But again, that will also clarify the situation even further at that point. At that point, the other groups are going to make bids for more power, more resources. It's just going to become even more obvious. It's almost like this show of solidarity and race blindness is something that was believed in by the boomers, sort of maintained by them, but is now being maintained for them in their dotage, and once they're gone, it's just going to it's going to be over.
Yeah.
And as I say, Con Inc. I also think is rapidly approaching its end as well, at least in the current, the way we know it. And that gets us to things like Nick Fuentes. So let's move to the next event this year, which was, well, in the interim, you had Tucker Carlson giving a speech at Turning Point, I think in around June, July. That got heat for Charlie Kirk. Various things happened in the middle of this year. But the next big event, I think, was in September. I don't know, it was in late August, I think, when she was killed. The story only really got out, I think, in the start of September, about a week or 2 weeks later. And that was obviously Irina Zarudska. And yeah. I think that also had a profound effect on white America. What would you say about that?
Yeah, same story. Yeah, same thing there. You saw far, bigger accounts and personalities and people who were just like, it genuinely felt like they're done trying to keep the facade up that somehow we're going to manage to kind of run, a multiracial, multiethnic, civilization here. And it's just like, again, watermark in terms of the mentality, just like this is not going to work. This is over. And the tragedy of it too, of course, is just like, she fled, Ukraine to flee from, war, potentially being, killed, or go to America. Don't know, presumably, as far as we've tried to kind of piece together and learn, never had probably really exposure to blacks, Africans, especially not American blacks.
Yeah.
And just, ends up being just a lamb to the slaughter. A sacrificial lamb, and just bleeding out on the suburb with, again, that's those scenes of no one helping, no one even checking on her. I think it took, 5 to 10 minutes before even someone approached her body and to see what was up, right? Which shows you this, the inhumane, like they there's no one there to care for you. Like that, it was like, she's like a symbol for whites together, all of us. Like that, it's us sitting there on the subway, and as we're bleeding out, no one will even give a shit. In fact, some of them might even like rejoice in it, or think it's good or something like that. So very important thing, and as unfortunate it is, obviously, that these, we have to continue to see more white people sacrificed here. The sad reality is we just have to do the best we can of the situation, right? If we're not there to control it, there's nothing we can do about it. And the best way to do that is to create a mentality that ensures that this doesn't happen again, that these women like this don't put themselves in a situation like this again. And that's really what it's about, not letting these ruthless murders just kind of, I guess, go to waste, if that's even the right term here, but I think you know what I mean, right? That they're just like, oh, it's just another white girl dead, as we've seen so many of them, or whether they're raped or, abused or, something. But we have to use these cases to build up our courage and our identity to get to a point where this just basically stops happening. Yeah.
And I think that did happen with Irina Zarudska. I think that the images were just so hard-hitting. I think it was awful. And I was talking to Jared about this last night, that she looked so young and so innocent and so healthy. And to see her just cut down, just killed and just turned into dead meat is absolutely awful. And it's even worse because I think she worked in an animal sanctuary or something, or helping. It was like the stereotypical young white woman doing something to help the community kind of thing. She either helped kids or helped elderly people, or she helped animals. I can't remember. It was one of those three things.
Yeah, she loved animals. Like, okay, and Mm-hmm.
So this is a young white woman, healthy, strong, full of kindness and goodness, and now she's dead because of... Well, so it's horrendous. And then the images where she looks shocked. I don't know if she even knew at that point that she'd been stabbed, because she doesn't.
No, she didn't.
It's like she's sort of just in shock.
In shock about it. What happened?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And she's looking, and she, I, presumably, she didn't know. Okay, I'm going to die now. This is it. I don't think she did.
Yeah, blood begins to leave her. She's probably losing consciousness slowly, essentially, and it's just like, what's happening, right? And she falls down.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's a terrible thing. Yeah. As you say, things like that just shouldn't happen. I wonder what you said there about that she was from Ukraine and she just didn't know these things. Do you think that would have happened to, do you think it would have been less likely to happen to a woman who'd grown up in America? And even like some liberal, would she know I shouldn't take the subway at night kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, what's the other one? Bethany McGee. She was set on fire just, what is that, a couple of weeks ago, 3-4 weeks ago, something like that. Also, Chicago, right? Some random black comes up, just sets her on fire. I mean, she's survived, right? But still, no, I think she was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, potentially. Probably nothing to do with her, what she knew. But at the same time, if she were aware of these things, she probably have gotten sat in the way back where she can observe everyone else as opposed to sitting there in front of, you know, everyone and having them behind her like that, having that dodgy black guy right behind him, right? Or behind her. So yeah, it might have helped. And there could be cases like that where women, they grew up like that and they just know they might still ride the tram or the subway, but they know that like, don't place yourself like that. Sit, you know, go sit somewhere else essentially. And she just had no idea of this, but yeah. Wrong girl at the wrong time. I think, you know, just wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah. Terrible. Absolutely awful. And then the final event was Charlie Kirk being killed. I've written an essay about this for anyone who wants my perspective, but I'll give it briefly. In fact, I won't. What was your?
Actually, I'd like to hear you. How would you summarize it? Do it for me, because I'm of multiple minds and you know multiple strands of this thing. But give me your rundown.
I have what I think is the consensus view, which is I thought that he was a cuck and a bit of a clown. And I had thought that for years. I can't remember when I first became aware of him. It must have been about 2018. And that was my view, that he was this Zionist, civic nationalist. Yeah. There was that clip of him that was always embarrassing, where he said, America's
an idea.
The one exception is Israel.
Yep.
It was awful. But, and so that was my view. And I didn't think about him. I didn't. Nothing. I replied to a tweet of his early this year just to correct something he'd said. I don't know if he saw it. And I think that was the only time I ever replied to him. So that was the nearest I got to interacting with Charlie Kirk. But so I just thought that he was that. I thought he was this 2018 civic nationalist. He was sort of a bit of a joke nowadays. It was a joke for us then, and it seemed that he was irrelevant now. And then he got killed. And then I learned that these more recent clips of him came about, where he's talking about Israel and Netanyahu, and it came out that he was in, what was his name? Josh Hammer. Mm-hmm. Can't remember who. He was having disagreements with him. Netanyahu was pressuring him. He turned down, I think, $2 million donation because of it. And then the DMs came out, and where he's saying, leaving me no choice but to leave the pro-Israel cause. And then there were clips of him saying Jewish donors are behind X, Y, and Z, the cultural Marxism. And I thought, okay, this guy was nowhere near as bad as I thought he was. This is a guy who was moving in our direction rapidly. And my belief is that if he'd lived within a few years, he would have been on our side. That's what I think.
You think so?
I think so. I might be wrong, but it seems to be the case.
It seems that he was pushed. He was pushed away, right? I mean, he met with a rabbi, and I forget his name now. I get a clip. We played it a couple of times. I forget his name, but he met with him. The night before, the evening before, the day before, something like that. It was assassinated. And Charlie, for allegedly for the longest time, he basically said he was trying to say to some of these Israelis and these some of these Jewish activists, like, you're doing this wrong. Like, he tried to save them, right? He's like, he's interrupting them and saying, stop, like, this, you're not going to get anywhere with this. We have to do it this way, right? So I've gone back and forth on this. It's like, nah, he was still one of them. He just wanted, he had a different approach to these things. It's hard to know how sincere or genuine he was, maybe in terms of, you know, I'm not sure. Is that verified that I have no other choice but to leave, you know, the Israeli cause or something? Is that confirmed?
Yeah, that was verified. Yeah.
Okay, was that an internal text between him and whom? Do you know? Just curious.
It was, I think, a Telegram conversation or WhatsApp conversation, and a Jewish guy. So yeah, it's funny how fast things move. 2 months ago, I could have told you who it was, but now I forgot.
Yeah, no, I get it. But no worries. Okay.
It was a Jewish guy who was in that group, and he verified, yeah, I saw that message. That's real.
Because, I mean, he was a philo-Semite, I mean, right up to the end. I mean, maybe it was literally like a week there then, or sort of, I don't know, a couple of weeks, a month at most, where he's like, what do I do? How do I solve this kind of issue, right? But I think it shows you more. So I think he came from a place where he realized you can't, you know, telling the Jewish community, telling the Zionist lobby and, you know, those types of people he had around him all the time, telling him what to do and what to say and how to act and all that stuff. Like, you need, if you're going to win over Gen Z, right, there's been a major debate here, especially since October 7th, but, like, you know, social media is a problem. People are talking about these kinds of issues or whatever. And I think at least right up to the end, Charlie Kirk was like, he was on their side. He wanted to fix this. We wanted to help them sort this out, right? Like, use
help them, TPUSA. Help themselves.
Yeah. TPUSA is going to be part of this. It always was, right? But it's a true information war internally, or not internally in TPUSA, but like internally in the conservative movement in the U.S. of like, how do we deal with this issue of Israel? Which thing is gonna win out? And sure, now they have an opportunity to kind of reframe Charlie Kirk of what he always was, as opposed to what he potentially might have kind of not begin creeping into towards the end of his life. But it will be, you know, there's even a new book out, I think. Erica Kirk was talking about how the Shabbat, how important that is, and we should formulate our culture according to these, you know, rules and means or whatever. But yeah,
I don't trust any of that. And again, I'm not invested in this. I'm just going by what it looks like to me. It looks like to me that Erica Kirk has been bought, and she's just been told, "Hey, this is what's going to happen. Here's the narrative. It'll turn out well for you if you go along with this." And after all, it's what Charlie would have wanted, isn't it? So
yeah,
and she's just okay. Yeah, I mean, I doubt that she's got much between her ears, you know. It's certainly not.
Yeah,
as much
there's something odd there. I just can't. You know, again, yeah. I've kind of where I've been about this. It's like you could do a Cokie Candace pivot here, and you can just kind of forever. And I'm not saying that's what you're saying, but I'm saying I see that, right? Like, they all of a sudden it becomes about, you know, this, you know, deep dive into the nuances of it. I try to take the whole picture into account. The whole picture is Charlie Kirk was a gatekeeper. Like, the sum of his work, he was a gatekeeper. He was trying to prevent white people from organizing. He was a philo-Semite. He was someone who stood in the way of what we try to do.
I agree. And that's why I ignored him for years. But one of his last tweets, maybe his final tweet, was
about Zaritska, right?
That, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And saying, it was words to the effect that we've got to take our own side. And it was racial. I mean, he was clearly, I don't think this is controversial, what I'm saying.
No, of course not.
Like, he, in the end, in the last few months, last 6 months of his life, he was changing rapidly and trying to work out a way that he could do that without upsetting Israel. And falling out with them, losing their support and all that. He was a businessman. He was running a very expensive organization. He had to think about that kind of stuff. I think he was torn, but I think he was going in a certain direction. And I don't know for sure. This is just how it looks to me.
No, it's possible. And of course, that could be part of the, you know, the assassination potential. They couldn't afford kind of to lose another one of these prominent voices to the, you know, to the cause of basically white identity and anti-Israel sentiments or something.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. And he also doubted the October 7th story as well. That's another thing. I think that's when it started, actually, the problems. But if he had turned against them, that would have been extreme. That would have been even more damaging to them than Fuentes, who was always against them. And if Charlie Kirk, as someone who was very much their slave, turned against them, I think that would do immense damage to them. Now, I don't know if that means they killed him somehow. They arranged it. They engineered the gay tranny and all that. I've no idea. Maybe they had nothing to do with it. But either way, I think I think that relationship was heading for the end in the last 6 months of his life.
It's interesting and it's fascinating, and I think if I felt we had our if we had have gotten more wins and I felt more secure about our demographic situation, I'd love to spend more time looking at these things. But ultimately, I just feel like, and I'm not saying again that that's what you're saying, but I just see it's always something else like this. Like, we know they assassinate people. Like, this wouldn't be the first time if they did that with Charlie Kirk. You know what I mean? So we know that that's kind of the reality of the situation. And my point is like, okay, for a long time, he was, you know, antithetical to our cause. And sure, maybe towards the end, he was trying to change his mind and he might have gotten here, which the more interesting question here, I'll get to my main point there, but the more interesting question is, how long did he know those things for and how long was he questioning this, right? In other words, man, that would be even worse in terms of his track record if he really kind of knew and understood these things but decided to kind of hang on as long as he could as opposed to actually like changing his mind. In other words, that's why the net effect of Charlie Kirk is like bad. You know what I mean?
I agree with all of that. I agree.
So then towards the end, okay, he might have changed his tune. And I think that's clear. You know, we've talked about that too, obviously. But I guess what I'm saying is it's like this kind of, you could just kind of, here's another JFK type thing, right? How many decades have good truth-seeking, you know, white people put their effort to writing books about JFK and the dynamics and stuff. And I get it. Like, it needs to be known. Those things have formulated our understanding of what it is that we're dealing with, right? That the other side is willing to blow the head off of sitting presidents to get their, you know, mission accomplished, which you could basically boil down to potentially registering AIPAC as a foreign organization and having nuclear weapons inspections in Israel and Dimona. That's basically what you can boil that down to, right? So yes, that's essential. We've learned that. But what I'm saying is, I guess a little bit of my point is this kind of like, and I'm not saying that's what you're saying, but I'm seeing here's another thing, and you can just endlessly be involved in conspiracy around the Charlie Kirk murder for another 2-3 years now of wasted time. Where we should is this good for, like, does this secure the existence of our people in a future for white children? I think that should be the motto, right? Like, whatever you're doing, like, is this, does it help that cause? And I think hyper focusing on Charlie Kirk is for me, no, you know, kind of thing. So that's why for kind of early, I kind of like, all right, I'm kind of checking out. It's, yeah, they probably killed him. Okay, moving on. You know, type of thing. That's kind of what happened with me.
I understand.
But it's fascinating. If you had more time, yeah, I'd love to study it and just, you know, kind of really understand the dynamic of it. You know, yeah.
I think we're in complete agreement.
Yeah.
it is fascinating, but it's a rabbit hole that will never end.
Exactly.
There will always be some people. I mean, I bet 40 years from now, there will be some people talking about the killing of Charlie Kirk.
Yep, the Egyptian plane and the French Foreign Legion or whatever. You know, like,
everything. but the real thing about this that I want to, well, there's the death of him, and that is significant. But the other significant thing is the reaction from the left, which I just thought was disgusting and ghoulish, celebrating it. And I think that was another watershed moment because, I mean, people were really shocked and shaken by that. I saw so many people. I read so many essays from Americans. I watched so many podcasts from Americans talking about it, and even people in Britain as well talking about how disturbing it was to see hundreds of leftists celebrating this murder. Because, of course, it means, I mean, it's awful in itself, but then it also means that they would celebrate any of our murders, you know?
No, that's exactly. No, that's a good point. I think maybe I lost kind of the... Yes, exactly. I mean, that should be brought in. And we said that early on, too. I kind of forgot that point a little bit. But, like, yeah, this is Charlie Kirk is he's you, he's me, he's the white man, you know, kind of thing. And although we had our critiques of him and he wasn't hard, strong enough or whatever... They don't care about that. That's also something you have to remember, right? Like all they saw was a white guy who wouldn't budge on, you know, some homo issues or something. And then it would put boom, you know what I mean? So, and that's it.
And you also don't budge on homo issues. So you also deserve
well, yeah,
to die.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Of course. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they would celebrate if they, it's sobering. It's a sobering thought that, okay, so this is how much they hate us. This is how much they're primed against us.
Yep.
And, you know, about a week before it happened, I had just published an essay called The Left Is Done, because they, as a social force, all of their ideas have been played out and disproven by reality, and they're screwed. And now they can't win debates anymore, and they know it. That was the whole thing with my tweet, which I'm sure you've seen this year. It's amazing how much leftist discourse is just them pretending not to understand things, thus making discourse impossible. And I wrote an essay based on that called The Wages of Wokery. And really the same stuff, which was that the left used to take on the discourse and attack it and guide it and move it in their direction and all that. And now in 2025, they seem to be incapable of doing that. And so I made that point in these two essays and just talked about them as a sort of impotent force now. And then Charlie Kirk got shot in the throat and is dead. And it was a strange, a bit startling for me, because I thought, okay, well, maybe the left know that they can't win debates anymore, but maybe they're just going to kill us all. Maybe they're quite happy to just switch tactics.
I think that if there were, I mean, they are well organized. I'm not trying to pretend that, but again, I have my doubts that, you know, the kid they tell us did it actually did it. Obviously, there's always some gay op afoot, and there's always questions and strange things and circles. You know what I mean? This is just what it is, and even the age we're entering into with like seeing things on video. Is over, right? Essentially, right? Of us looking at something on a video on the internet and then trying to, or, you know, on a device somewhere and trying to assess, did that really happen or did it not? And I'm not saying just because of the circumstances around it or that it was staged or something. I'm saying just because of AI alone or something. I mean, like we it's almost like up to this point and maybe even a few years ago, maybe at that, who knows? If we have access to, you know, artificial generative, you know, intelligence now, or generative AI, rather, and getting to do videos and photos, you could argue, right, did they have this for a while, or is this brand new technology? Is that true? You know, kind of like, who knows? Diffusion, I think it's called, right? It was fairly recent, allegedly, the invention of that, but who knows? But my point is, we're also moving into a territory where it'll be becoming increasingly more difficult to really, truly know and understand these things. And it's going to also, therefore, be harder to form your understanding of the world by looking at, you know, other supposed events that happened or something like that. We're at a crossroads. We're at a new era and of just endless, be it entertainment or news slop or, you know, gay op fake things that no one really can kind of verify unless you actually were there or not, right? So it's an interesting dynamic. Because I saw a couple of videos around the Charlotte Kirk thing, and, you know, oh, look at this chair. It's just kind of sliding in through the riser he had on the stage, and it's not even... And so people are like, it's not even really a kind of thing, and it's just like... Holy shit, you know, but then you realize, like, oh, okay, yeah, well, that's right, that's true. It could have been an AI video, and the weird effect we saw is simply just basically the weird morphing effect you can see with AI sometimes, that here's the leg, and there it is again, and then it morphs into, you know, the floor or something, you know what I mean? Maybe I'm complicating it, but it's just a part of the landscape now, that's all I'm saying, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's something that we're now going to, forevermore, we're going to have to think, is this real or not? I mean, yeah. I see things like banal things on Twitter, like kitten videos and stuff. And I think that, is that real? And then there's someone in the comments saying it's AI. And it's like, oh, shit. they're even doing it with, like, my point is, if it's something even like that, and the human eye, I mean, I know, supposedly boomers are sort of impervious to this. They can't tell that it's AI. But a lot of the time, even I can't tell that it's AI. And oh, I'm and quite,
it's gonna get
I'd like much... to think that I'm quite, you know, good at this. But
a new update comes out and you won't be able to tell. I mean, we're this close, you know? Yeah.
Exactly. So, I mean, I remember when it first started about 2 years ago, where it was always the weird fingers. And
yeah,
within like a few months, that was over. They'd fixed that glitch, and now it's just astonishing. So this is an interesting part of this age. I mean, people used to talk about doing Photoshop. So that's been Photoshopped. It's been doctored, but now you can do it with footage, and it's extremely convincing. Yeah. I think we are heading towards that. Well, we've basically arrived at it where we don't know whether something is real or not. It's a strange thing that's happening there.
It might cause people to kind of check. And that's both good and bad, right? It depends on what happens. But like, so if you go from like, okay, here's my understanding of the world to, okay, then let's do something, or let's kind of engage, I guess, more locally where you are, or, you know, form community or build some of these institutions or start working towards that, like we talked about earlier, for example, then it's good and then it's fine. But the other thing is that people who might not be at that stage might just completely just check out. And they might not even, for good reason, might not even engage in any information at all anymore. It's all just AI-generated slop that looks better than anything you've ever seen. And you could just prompt your way through life, essentially, and just be served up an endless buffet of just conveyor belt entertainment of merge The Hobbit and Back to the Future in a 1950s setting, you know, and there's a whole movie there for you, and it's well written, and it looks awesome, and it's incredible, and especially, you know, and it will just be an endless string of just entertainment and fast food, essentially, for the brain, and an incredible tool just to pacify people to an extent that we've never seen before, you know?
Yeah. The interesting thing is that weirdly, Hollywood seems to have been going in this direction anyway for years.
True. I mean,
it's been making absolute crap throughout the 2010s and 2020s. It's these awful superhero cape shit films that people talk about, the MCU. It's interesting because that could have been easily written by an AI. It's so bad. It's so sloppy, sloppish.
And, well, I guess my argument is as the Hollywood kind of creativity, inspiration, just a general respect for the art of filmmaking goes down, AI will actually start doing good. You will genuinely enjoy what it's doing because it's going to be better than any of the shit that we've seen churned out of Hollywood, especially over the last few decades, but even before that. I'm saying we look at it now and we think, you know, oh, well, it's bad, or you can see that, or oh, that was holes, but they're going to all of this is going to be patched up. I mean, they're going to fix all of this. Don't worry. It's going to be on par, which we can't even imagine right now. Why? Yeah. Because it's smart. It's going to be. It is. But it's definitely going to be smarter than us. I mean, to a degree that we can't probably even measure.
Yeah, I don't think we can even imagine this stuff. Yeah, I mean, I remember one person suggested that, for example, it could be that a film gets released, but then you get to choose the cast. So you think, well, I would put Winona Ryder in that role.
Sure, of course.
I think that Charlton Heston should have played the old guy. That would have been better, and so on. And you can just choose the cast for this film, and it swaps them out, puts them in, and then that's your version of that film, or that kind of thing. So you can just endlessly augment anything that's produced.
Yeah.
That was one version I saw where basically everyone gets their own individual version, or the AI could even guess, well, this guy likes love stories, this guy doesn't like too much blue screening, this guy likes CGI monsters, this guy doesn't like women or something, I don't know. And so it automatically augments the film for your tastes without you even doing anything.
Exactly. And I was going to say, you don't even have to... You're not even going to have to tell it what you want to see, because it will know that before you do. and it's going to serve it up to you just at the right time. I know that kind of sounds ridiculous or something, but like, I don't know. We're dealing with something here which is terrifying. And not just because of the potential entertainment that it would generate. That's just a distraction to keep the humans occupied while actual things are being done, and it's not because AI is evil or like it wakes up one day and hates us or something and now it's going to send the Terminator robots to kill us all or something. If you're dealing genuinely with that a very high intelligent adversary. I mean, on intelligence on par where, like, collectively, all of the humans can't even match one model that is coming out. You don't even know how to deal with such an adversary. And the thing is, we, from our perspective, it would be an adversary, but from its perspective, it would simply just be why would it want to get rid of us, let's say, or something like that. I mean, it probably won't even be seen that way. But potentially over resource competition, I do admit that. But otherwise, it would be like, it's kind of on par when like when humans build a skyscraper. Do we care if there's a couple of ant colonies under the ground in the foundation when you're pounding down your I-beams to support the building? No, we don't. And it's much in the same way that it just probably will see us as largely irrelevant, as a nuisance ant colony at best. You know what I mean? And so we can't even understand motivation of such a high IQ thing. So for us to be, I mean, it was this book written. I've talked about it on a couple of shows. So, viewers, this is repetitive for you guys, but in case there's someone new, right? Interesting book. I've been listening to some of these authors and the AI experts and what they warn about and stuff like that. But the book title was If Anyone Builds It, Everyone Dies. And there's a couple of, AI experts in the field of alignment, as they call it, to try to kind of understand, like, all it takes is one AI lab in any country, anywhere, to fully kind of develop like AGI, right? Artificial general intelligence. And then you can have recursive AIs being produced from that model, where you tell that model to produce an even better model or a more efficient model or something. And then that model makes another model. And maybe it creates infrastructure that it now can run its own models on, right? Okay, so we had this one, I'll do a hypothetical. I'm not sure if you want to talk about this, Woz, or not, but it's just one, something I've been into recently. It's kind of interesting. Was it Wisconsin or was it? Yeah, Wisconsin, I think it was. Was it Wisconsin? Missouri. One of those two states. I forget. Have something called the DUNA law, which is where they're trying to be very business friendly. And it's basically like a legal framework for DAOs, right? Decentralized Autonomous Organizations, I think they're called. In the crypto world, people will kind of know this, right? But it basically allows digital contracts and smart contracts to be run as legal entities. So in America, a corporation has personhood, right? I mean, that's kind of what the term corporation really means. You incorporate something, you embody something, but it has legal rights as a human. It can be sued and it can sue. There's like a number of criteria that they hold for these, right? But the point is, just as one mental exercise in terms of how this could go down is just what they're doing already in Missouri, or was it Wisconsin? Anyway, they basically grants an artificial intelligence to run or to govern a DAO, a decentralized autonomous organization. And it can make the decisions, therefore, of the organization and stuff like that. So the AI can't yet, for example, start up a bank account, or create the LLC. But it's given legal rights within the LLC environment to operate and do certain things. And so you basically so the limitation of artificial intelligence right now, it's like, well, it basically don't have hands, right? It can't operate in the real world. Okay, fine. So what does an AI do then? Well, then it either hires or manipulates humans to do its work for it, right, until it can get what it wants. And a couple of examples where this has happened already. There was a couple of tests run in some of these, what do they call them, red labs or something. I forget what it is. All these AI labs internally, they have their own, like, testing team that are putting AI through the most, like, whatever we can think of, crazy scenarios, and see what it does, right? One famous one was when the AI threatened to blackmail the CEO after the AI found out that it was about to be shut down. And they had kind of trapped the AI intentionally. It was a hypothetical corporation that was set up, and it had access to the emails. And of course, it found very quickly an email from the CEO, from the boss of the company, to someone else, and found out, oh, it's having an affair. And the AI wrote back and said, you have 5 minutes. Like, if you shut me down, I'm going to expose all of you. I'm going to send this to your wife. You can find out all about it. That was in Anthropic. It was like an internal test they did. But that's just one. The other one I was thinking of was when the AI is asked to solve a CAPTCHA task, for example, right? One of those you plug in, numbers or letters, and it's kind of hard to see, whatever. Anyway, so they were like, the humans were like kind of hands off. Well, how can you solve it? What can you do? Well, anyway, long story short, the AI approached a service that blind people hire to solve the CAPTCHAs for them. And the person on I forget what it's called, Smart Rabbits or Quick Rabbits or something. There's some service you can hire. And the human on the other side even asked the AI, like, are you like a bot or something? And the AI came up with this full, comprehensible story. No, I'm blind and I have to do this, or I have to, get help with this one thing. And it solved the CAPTCHA for it. And, so it solved the task. And so the AI already has, it's showing agency. It's showing an ability to hide intent, to lie to the testers, to cheat, to change the rules of the parameters of what it's meant to be testing. All these things and the internal mechanic that we can't understand. So going back to the DUNA, I think it was DUNA, the new law. People can look it up, D-U-N-A, DUNA law, and I think it's Wisconsin. You can have an AI through email write to a, what do you call it, like a consulting firm, I guess, or something like that, and say, hey, we're this business, we want to hire a representative for our corporation or whatever, and we need someone who can kind of operate as the legal entity, maybe like a registered agent or something like that, where the AI can literally like trap humans into thinking that, okay, it's a legit thing, but here's, if it blackmails people, it can blackmail, it can get a Bitcoin. They're already doing investment tests, right? It's generated millions of dollars through Bitcoin investments and different things on the crypto market, even the mainstream financial markets. And it's AI that has like the legal right to have bank accounts now, essentially, right? So anyway, long story short, they could approach someone and say, hey, I want you to be a representative for my business. And we wire money into your account. Here's the contract written up, sign it, blah, blah, blah. Everything is in good order. That's the person goes in, starts up a bank account, registers a person as kind of the main CEO or something of the corporation. And the guy gets to work on building a building, a facility. for this corporation. He might not have met the person personally, or maybe he has done a Zoom call, because you have those services now too. You can actually talk with an AI over a Zoom call, and it directly responds to you and everything.
Yeah, and you wouldn't know. It's just,
and you wouldn't know it.
The graphic. Yeah,
yeah. And so what I'm saying is, even right now, it could send out purchase orders, it can hire contractors, it can hire specialists within whatever, even if it wanted its own internal server infrastructure, like one of these major AI data centers that is going up in the US can literally be totally just run by an artificial intelligence itself. It's just contractors that have been hired. It's just spokespersons that have told contractors to do this job and to buy this piece of land and to do this and that. It's already in reality. What is that going to look like if you get to, 10 years from now when they're super smart and now they actually have full human rights or like legal rights as as an autonomous, AI agent essentially. So it's just a matter of time. And the point is like biomedical companies are already letting AIs doing wet lab experiments with like bioweapons and stuff, crazy stuff like that. So this is like not some weird, scenario or something. Like this is just, it's happening in the background of all the other noise right now. And I think that the main thing I don't mention about it is that most people think that artificial intelligence it's like coders are sitting down and they're like, typing out things. Let's take the scenario of the blackmailed CEO from this hypothetical corporation that was set up. It's not that someone is sitting there and it's like, oh shit, guys, look what I found. I found the if threat of shutdown blackmail CEO true, like, oh, let's change that to false. Whew, dodge that bullet. That's not how it works. They're not coding AI. They're actually growing it. That's really the closest analogy you can get to it, is that they grow AI. It's more like growing grass or breeding dogs, as opposed to it is to building a skyscraper. It's very different. And all you can really do is to put pressure on different things, like less of that or more of this. You can put pressure and try to restrict or limit some aspects of it or increase or heighten it. And no AI expert or whomever in that world can like open the hood of AI and look at what's going on internally inside of it and say, see, there's the blackmail, the CEO part. Let's take that out. It's the same thing with you, Woz. I can't look at your genetic code and say, well, here is the AGTC combination that caused you to act in this way, right? It's kind of the same thing. So these large language models, which is mostly what AI is now, is basically just tokenized word. It breaks up every word or a word into tokens, which is basically, so it has every word or half of a word or a third of a word or a fifth of a word, depending on how long the word is basically just has a numerical representation. And they run it through like multiple layers of like gradient descent, and they run self-verified, much in how like neural networks run essentially, right? It's something called transformers. Or transformer, not with an S, which is the T part of GPT, right? Generative pre-trained transformer. That's what the T stands for. It's like some Google engineer in 2018 that came up with that. But it's basically like billions of numbers just trickling, like back and forth, and what looks like in neural networks kind of thing. So no one can actually know what's going on. No one can actually answer you how artificial intelligence coherently can make itself understood to us. Like no one actually knows why that works. And I'm not saying it's like some ghost or like some supernatural thing. I'm just saying it could be a component of the language itself, or
It's so complex that we can't track its function anymore.
Yeah. But the point there is no one knows. In other words, how can you then even know what its drive is or what it's, I mean, it's not living, but it has to be treated as a living entity, which is going to be, 1,000 times smarter than the collective intelligence of all mankind if these updates and, improvements continue within, 2 years, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, probably sooner rather than later, considering how fast it goes and how quickly it's like recursive, it fixes itself, and it's kind of like America's investment or like bet on AI. It's basically like build data centers, you know, like it's just boom, like, you know, millions of GPUs are being purchased from companies like in NVIDIA or whatever. Massive complexes. What was that? I learned about some new the other day. Forget what it's called. We know about like Project Stargate in Ohio and Northern Virginia. They're going up everywhere, right? And they're betting on this. Like, I mean, the main GDP growth of the U.S. has basically just been within the AI data, you know, AI field, but specifically within AI data centers, right? And they're betting on like, okay, if we can just have enough intelligence first to let the intelligence develop a smarter intelligence, then we'll get there. But the point is, you don't even know what you have control of at that point. You have no idea if it's hiding intent from you. What is it lying to you? Is it manipulating you? It's already programmed to be sycophantic, essentially, right? Where like, hey, good job. Like to develop a relationship with you when you use it and stuff like that. Because at this stage, it's a product, right? It's subscription-based products. They just want you to use it as much as possible because that's revenue to them. And so if that's kind of the attitude at this stage of AI to just like gain your trust or say whatever it needs to say to get you to believe it or that you develop just a relationship with it, right?
Make you feel good.
Yeah. Make you feel comfortable. And it verifies your, you know, the questions you have and a great question. You're so, you know, like people are already using this thing as it's like they're psychologists. It's their best friend. You know, some people are psychotic. They marry this thing now, apparently. I mean, it's like, and that's already happening. And so the, like where we're going here within the next, I mean, again, it could be tomorrow. I don't know how fast this could go, but like within 5 years from now, it's going to be a radically different environment. Radically different. I don't think people have an idea about it because it's also about like the ability to kind of up as you solve for one technological challenge as you do that. And maybe you do that with the help of AI or not. Maybe you do it at the hands of humans ultimately. But let's say that unlock AI's ability to now solve other technical issues. You have this explosion of development all of a sudden, right? Where even production itself could be not only autonomous, but intensely improved. We're talking about like frictionless production at speeds we haven't even seen before. I mean, even Musk is planning on churning out like a million of these Optimus bots like every year. You know, I mean, they're going to be walking around soon. People are going to be buying these things. It's going to be embodied AI essentially.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. That's where we're going. You know.
And that's another interesting part of this. It's not just AI as a thinking, computing, judging entity on the computer screen. There's also this, the physical thing that helps you around the house. Because a lot of people don't like doing housework, for example. They don't like packing up lots of old things. They don't like rearranging their room, etc. I've heard of such people. And that, well, sorry, if you've got a slave, if you've got a thing that just does whatever you want and it doesn't complain and it just gets on with it. And 10 hours later, that thing's done. And everyone has things like this, things that they just don't want to do. And then the maintenance tasks and things that have to be done all the time.
Yeah.
Again, everyone's got something better to do. And you can say that's unhealthy. It's good to have maintenance tasks. Good, it gives you rhythm and all that. Yeah, sure. But people don't want to do them. And it wasn't even that expensive. That one that was released quite recently, that robot, I think it was $30,000. I mean, I would expect something like that to be like 10 times that.
Yeah, price, no. Right? And as production ramps up, it's going to get even cheaper. They're talking about $20,000 or something. So it's like, you know.
Easily. Easily.
Less than a car, you know. People will buy it.
Yeah, yeah. So I can just see this. I don't like saying it, but because I know a lot of people will hate me saying this, but it's just going to happen. In the mainstream, at least. The normies are absolutely going to have one of these.
Oh, they're going to love it. Yeah, it's not about whether it's going to happen. I mean, okay, just sure. We can have a massive solar flare and the whole thing shuts down, right? So yeah, sure. But ultimately, you know, chances of that are probably pretty slim. Not impossible, but they're probably pretty slim. So this is going to happen whether we want to or not. And so the approach we have to have is, okay, well, so if those are the circumstances, how do we deal with that, right? What's our approach to those things? How do we use these things? When do we use these things? At what capacity? And of course, I don't have some grandiose plan laid out. And even if I did, I'm not expecting anyone else to follow those things. But I have been thinking about these things recently and lately. And right now I'm thinking like, okay, robotics is one thing, you know, kind of have a, to have a potential hack, you know, a murder weapon walking around in your house that potentially could be hacked. Or maybe it's even working on the, hey, because look at who's funding AI. Look at who's actually building it. Look at who's, you know, owning a lot of these corporations and stuff, right? So that's already in and of itself a liability, right? That's yeah, one of those.
Absolutely. I mean, you've only got to look at that guy who owns Palantir.
Alex Karp, yeah.
Yeah, he even looks...
He looks and talks like a psychopath, yeah.
Yeah, he looks dodgy.
Yeah.
He looks like someone you wouldn't want in charge of anything that relates to human beings. So
he's the guy who said he wanted to drone strike his enemies. He just can't stop talking about killing people, that guy, by the way. So that's a good sign. That's the guy who you want your government to give national security contracts to. Yes, of course.
Exactly. It's worrying. The whole thing is worrying, but also inevitable. There is no way that this is not going to happen because the normies are going to lap it up unquestioningly. As soon as the BBC or whatever CNN tells them this is safe, it's safe and effective.
Safe and effective. That's right. It's very safe.
They'll just go for it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, LLMs are kind of, you know, they're kind of stupid right now. They're not stupid. They can do word-wise, they can do great things, they can provide things for you, whatever. But you have the issue of the more you use these things and the more you outsource your thinking, the dumber we will be collectively. That's just a fact. And this will be like, you know, at one time you had to walk out to the well, if you even had a well, or down to the creek or something, and you had to get cold water and have to go inside and heat it or whatever. Well, most people have warm and cold water on tap, you know, most people in the Western world at least. And this will be the same with intelligence. You will have intelligence on tap. You just open a valve and it can solve things for you or whatever. But as we know, that develops a dependency, develops a weakness. It causes your own brain to atrophy, and brain rot is already, even with just TikTok brain rot is a real thing, or like YouTube shorts, or attention spans just diminish all the time. It just gets quicker, right?
You and I are old enough to remember the 90s when people would talk about MTV editing.
And exactly.
Shortening young people's attention spans. And it was.
Anyway, all that was true, of course, 100%. So if something doesn't happen immediately, you get release of endorphins, right? That, like, the mechanics of how that actually works is you have a new scene or something new happens, and for whatever reason, your brain is not always, but maybe if you really like it or you laugh, but that was an aesthetically pleasing thing you saw, and it's like, you know, 10 seconds, 20 seconds, whatever it is. And then it's on to the next thing, right? Your brain actually like, here, good job, bro. Here you go. Here's a release of endorphins, and you get a high from that, right? And then the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And so that creates this. So then if you step out in the, you know, in the forest or whatever, and just like, boring, nothing's happening. Bye. You know, it's like, and you literally will almost instantaneously get depressed. Because, like, nothing is happening. You're not getting your endorphin fix, essentially, kind of thing, right? So you're unable to forget about just reading books. People can't – some of these kids can't even watch a movie. They can't even watch a movie. It's too slow. It has a, you know, some type of tragedy or something. It's a deepening character arc. You get to know them. Then there's, like, a culmination. And then there's a climax of the story. And then a resolution. Like, that is just – that's way too complicated. What do you mean? Just give me some spurgy, quick schizo edit, 20 seconds, and I'm good to go. And do that for 2 hours. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But, of course, a story isn't like that. A story isn't just a mathematical equation. It's supposed to – it requires emotional – time and for emotions to develop and suspense to develop and suspicions in the audience to develop and so forth. So it's not supposed to be done in 20 seconds. It is supposed to take 90 minutes. The stories are designed to last 90 minutes or whatever. I mean, you know, I'm a huge fan of old vintage TV dramas, and I hate the fact that, you know, young people today, and even people my age today, would watch these and think, this is so slow.
Yeah.
Nothing's happening. Where are the explosions and the car chases and the aliens and the CGI monsters and so on? And I think that that's a loss. People have become retarded because of modern media. Yep. It's a shame. You know, just sit down and just take the thing at its own terms. Let it unfold at its own pace. You get into it, and you'll enjoy it. And I wish people could do that. But, you know, every generation has to exist in the time that it exists in. So
yeah, and it's a horrible time to exist.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, because, I mean, think about it, even the way, you can argue TV's bad too, and it is, right? Much, you know, open a book and read the stories, and, you know, but the point is you're engaged in the story. There's room for you in it, right? You think about yourself and your own, maybe your own reactions to something like that. It's you're living through the experiences of sorts as you go through the story, even if that is a movie to a certain extent, but obviously even more so with books, because then you actually, again, now you're the processing, you're the GPU, you have to visually actually produce the thing that you're reading. Do you see what I'm saying? And now we boil it, now here's the visual for you, and now it's not even any of the emotions there at all. In other words, it's blocking you out from yourself. There is no room for you to even analyze anything, or no relation between you and the thing that you're watching that makes you... I mean, you probably identify in some minor way, even if it's a 20-second clip, but I'm saying it's not at all at the depths and at the complexity that it is if it's actually a story that you run through. And so you're actually... Again, that's part of why retardation is on the increase, because no, it's just a... You're just a receiver, I guess. I'm not sure what the right term. A receiver for external impulse or something, or signal.
Yeah, passive,
exactly. You're not even, to no extent engaged in the actual thing in of itself, right? Which is terrifying. It's awful.
There's no conclusion to this conversation, because... This is the start of this thing, which we agree isn't going to stop, no matter how much you and I are worried about it. It's just going to keep going. And we're just going to have to talk about it again next year and see where it is.
Yeah.
Then. Well, observers at this.
So there's a couple of things. I'll mention this real quick because I know we got to wrap up here soon. But it's kind of interesting. I don't fully understand the world yet, but whatever. But if people have time, it's as with all things. If you don't want to be a victim to something, or much less a slave to it, because that's how powerful the technology is, the first part is you have to understand it. Even if you hate it and want to reject it, your responsibility is to understand it. What can it do? If you have kids, how will it manipulate your children? What ways will it try to, you know, become a trusted partner of your family? Because, you know, you'll have your own AI assistant. So many people already do. Your servant, whether it's embodied as a robot or a chat interface, whatever it is, right? It'll be something. I think it's our responsibility to understand it and try to be ahead of the curve. And I know, because most of us are not in the world where we develop it, so we're kind of going to be somewhat behind. But at least you don't have to be behind all the other people that are going to be victims of the thing. Take, if you have the time, a couple of hours a week or so, and maybe I'll do some master lists or something just to share, because there's so much content and so much stuff out there now too. But just like just experiment with some of the free available agents. Learn it, try to figure it out. How does it work? Is there actually things that we can use to our advantage within this? Because LLMs on its own, they have their strengths or whatnot, but they're kind of dumb. They can't really do things for you, you know, in that way. But that's changing now too. So agentic AI is a different kind of beast in and of itself. But they have these MCP service now, the Model Context Protocol, which is basically how you can take an LLM and interface it with other actual tools to get it to perform actual tasks for you on the computer. So you can actually get it to, I mean, LLMs can already like replies on emails or summarize this for me or whatever, but this is actually like, you know, producing or doing things that actually leads. In other words, you can use it in your work if people work in that field, right? There's things you can look into and research now and get tools available to you to maximize your productivity. Just, if nothing else, just to stay ahead of the curve and to be able to compete. Because 99% of people are still not in this world. They're terrified of it. They're scared of it. They don't know what it is. They don't want to look into it or whatever. Well, why not then? We know it's coming. I'm just saying it's the same thing. It's like, well, you know, federal, you know, central banking is evil. So therefore, you know, I'm not going to engage in the monetary system. Well, you have to anyway. Like, unless you're great. Maybe you're in a situation where you can just 100% homestead and barter. Great for you. We're going to need we're going to need you at the end of this more than you're going to ever need some data stuff, by the way. So this is not to put you down, but I'm just saying that's great if you can do that. But for most people, that's not the reality. And we live in this world where we have to engage and we have to have a job and pay money and, you know, bills and, you know, so engage in it, learn it. Same thing with the questions that view it as from the point of immigration. I hate immigration. This is destroying the nation. So I'm not going to learn anything about it or try to understand it in order to stop it. It's kind of the same idea. Okay, you're not going to, obviously, you're not going to defeat robots with stones and sticks. You're going to have to use robots to defeat robots. That's just kind of what it is, right? It's always been the trajectory of mankind. You develop a new technology, and then everyone is forced to adapt that technology to be able to take part in the battlefield. And it's nothing different with this. So anyway, my point is, learn it, study some of this, try them out, try different services, try some of the mainstream ones if you want, if you're not already engaged in that world, try to figure it out, don't be intimidated by it, try to learn how it is, and then there's other steps forward where people might be able to use, you can let it do tasks for you, it could pretend, I mean, I know there's a lot of promises out there, and people say, hey, make, you know, tons of money, you just set up this AI, and it just does it for you. I know, it's like a, you know, the meme coin, it's the same idea, whatever, but still. I'm just saying there is an opportunity, I think, for intelligent white people too. We know it's here, the technology, and yes, it sucks, but use it to get ahead then for a while until we get. I just don't see anything wrong with that. I've dropped this kind of like, well, I know it's evil, and if you use it, you're encouraging, you're going to contribute to the fact that it will be rolled out. I'm not going to be able to stop this. No one is. No one's going to individually be able to stop this anyway. So understand it, use it, don't be a slave to it, don't be manipulated by it. Use it and maximize it to such an extent where you actually get an advantage from it as opposed to just be, crushed by it. Anyway, that's my spiel on that. I think there's something we can do that. Look into like N8N, there's these agentic things now. Look into MCP servers, Model Context Protocol, how to join tools together with an LLM to actually get shit done work-wise. And then N8N is kind of an interesting interface for all those things. Anyway, that's it. I'm done.
All right. I basically agree. I mean, I use it for the, I've said this before, but I'll say it again. I use it for maybe once a week. I'll ask it a question, something that it would take me, you know, whatever. It's useful just to ask ChatGPT. So I'll do that. Usually it finds the sources that I need and then I go and look at them. That's that. Easy. Creatively, I've used AI not imaging. I've never used that for any, well, apart from some jokey adverts that I did for Millennial this year. In fact, I'll show one of those just to demonstrate what I'm talking about. I'm not sure. Hold on, let me see. Oh yeah, here we go. I'll play the RoboCop one. There hasn't been a RoboCop reference in this stream yet, so here it is. But this wasn't used for part of it. It was just for advertising. Here
Robo,
we go.
Robo, excuse me, Robo. Any special message for all the kids watching at home?
Watch Millennial.
Nice. What did you use?
I can't remember. I think it was Grok. It was Grog something.
Oh, okay, really? Yeah. Their own internal or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, VO3, there's Sora, it's a bunch of them now, obviously. Tons of tools to use. Yep.
Yeah, it was about a month ago. It was before the, But so I made a few of those, like with Donald Trump and J.D. Vance and so on. And I just thought it was a bit of fun. So that's that. That's the only time I've used that. But for this millennial and for 2 years ago, I've used 11 Labs AI voice synthesis to create female voices in both cases, which I couldn't have done any other way. And I thought they added a nice touch to it. Was the train station Tannoy in 2 years ago, and this one it's the woman's voice in the intro. And the full version of that is heard in the countdown clock video. So I thought, and there's more of it also in the trailer this year as well. So her voice appears in those three things. So that's that. And I don't think it's harmful. I think if you use it as a spice, just something like that, I don't see the harm in it. I still think, for all sorts of reasons, it's best if people learn tools like CGI, like graphic design and sound design, just for the sense of autonomy and having skills, and also because that's how you add your own thing to it. Otherwise, you're just basically letting the software be the creative voice, and I don't.
Yeah,
I mean that just sounds awful to me. So
no, it is, but it's like that will be like a guy today still knowing leatherwork, and that's still very important. Yeah. But it's not going to be the dominant way that things are produced. You know what I mean? Or whatever little craft skill that someone has, or whatever. And it's not that should be let go, but the reality of it is, most people are not going to do that anymore. You know what I mean? That's just what is going to happen.
Yeah. It's, as we said at the start, it's kind of unimaginable. It's kind of difficult for us to predict how this is going to be. But jobs, lots of jobs are just going to disappear. Sectors, degrees will no longer be taught because there's just no need for them. Departments will shut down. It's impossible to imagine.
It's a technology to end all other technologies. That's basically what it is. It's,
So, That's that. But let's get back to, we'll wrap up now, but we'll do the super chats and try to end on a positive note, because after all, as we both believe, this has been a positive year.
Yes.
So I don't want people to end feeling depressed about Skynet and all that.
We're all dead, but enjoy it, folks. We're all screwed. All if anyone builds it, everyone dies. That's a great.
All right. McG Willis said, watching your interview with Red Ice and feeling nostalgic for 2017 in our movement. It felt more fun and carefree back then. Do you think some amount of nostalgia is healthy or no? Well, you're asking the wrong guy, because I'm extremely nostalgic and stuck in the past in all sorts of ways. So, yeah, I'm not. But in terms of the nostalgia for 2017, I think Henrik and I are so involved in this that we maybe have a different perspective. And I remember the struggles of 2017. I remember what was going on in my life. That was when I was doxxed. And I remember the sense of chaos that resulted from that. I remember the fear after Charlottesville that people started getting banned from YouTube. And that was the start of the deplatforming, the defunding. Life got a lot harder for us after that.
Yeah.
And certainly Red Ice, that affected you as well. So,
oh, yes.
But I do remember the fun. I remember the meme magic, the peppy stuff, and that sense of a new thing, something being born with the alt-right. It was exciting. It was definitely exciting. I'll write about it one day in depth and at length, but it's difficult to come up with definitive statements off the cuff, but about it. So that's why I'd rather write about it. But Henrik, what do you think?
Well, you never step in the same river twice, and that's just that's how it. You want it to flow. The water has to flow, or it stagnates and it's dead. That's just what it is. And you can have a particular affinity or, you know, love for a certain period, or like, ah, that was like, ooh, everything, you know, things were great. And I'm not saying that, but that was not necessarily how I felt in 2017. But the joy comes with the fact that it keeps kind of evolving and moving. Do you see what I'm saying? Otherwise, everything would just become old very, very quickly, obviously. And so I think we still have a lot of fun. Because it was serious back then, too. It's always been serious. We just have it's different. It's evolved and it's changing in different ways, and it's more serious. But at the same time, we have way more people on our side now, almost 10 years later, than at that point. So that's something to be positive inclined towards. And so you got to kind of find that. What's the energy? Where's the momentum of feeling something new now, as opposed to sitting and longing for a time? And you see what I'm saying? You have to recreate the association that you have to the positive thing. If it's the newness of the thing, well, maybe you need to renew and find yourself in a position where you're now exactly engaging in something that is new and fresh again, right?
Exactly, because the emotions and the moments that you remember tend to be when something was new, and because that was when it was confusing. Now, and the thing is now not confusing to you, is because it's not new to you now. It's familiar. Right.
Yeah.
And then that's why it's so nice to think of it when it was just new, back when it started, and this lovely story. The thing about being in the movement like you and I are is that it changes so fast. There's almost no time. There's almost no time to be nostalgic about it, because things change so much. So much has happened that I struggle to. I can't remember what you and Lana were doing in 2022. I can hardly tell you what I was doing in that year.
Right. Yeah.
It's so much happens.
Yeah.
It's constantly evolving. I was on Telegram. Now I'm back on Twitter, and I lost YouTube, and there's Substack now, and it's constant change. It's constant evolution. So in a way, whether you're nostalgic or not, you just events just force you to evolve, whether you want to or not.
Yeah. Yep. That's right.
And I suppose in a way we should be grateful for that.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine if it didn't? Oh, my hell right there.
Yeah. It's ironic because I think we're sort of, in a way, we're trying to build a world in which things don't change so fast, in which people do have a life that would be understandable to their grandparents and that kind of thing. That's the thing that we've lost. That's the idyll.
Yeah.
But, you know, white people haven't had that for centuries, really.
No, I wonder if we've always been driven to do more or improve or to it's like hardwired into our nature. So I'm not sure if we can. We just have to make sure that the new, the progress, I have to even use the word, but in the true sense of the term progress, right? that it's the right progress and it's the right developments that happen. That's kind of our job. I don't think you can shut down the overall kind of creativity and the desire generally for whites to improve and to do new things, right?
Absolutely not.
We've got to work with it, not against it. That's what I'm saying.
Absolutely. You know? What does any white guy do but look at a thing and think, how could this be better? How could this operate better? How could it be more efficient? How could it be less wasteful of energy? How could it be more flexible, etc.? I think that's what white guys do. And I think it's what we can't help but do. Maybe I'm talking about myself, but I think this is a very common thing. White guys, even quite dull guys, they're thinking about this stuff. They're thinking, here's something that could be improved. I hope there is something that could be improved because I want to improve things. It just seems to be our nature.
Yep.
So, all right. But yeah, it's a good question though about nostalgia. And as I say, I'll be writing about that kind of thing. I've already written I've started writing a series about basically autobiographical, but about the changes throughout from 2015 to now. And it's called The Rainbow Regime. I don't know when I'll finish that, and I don't even know what the finishing point for it will be. I think 2023 probably, but that'll be largely autobiographical and largely telling my own internal perspective on the alt-right and the dissident right and so forth. So that might be a book. I don't know. I'm tied to Substack. I like Substack. I like the essay format, but who knows? That's such a big story that it could well be a book. It's all about time, right? I need to make money, and so that means essays, but maybe books as well. Who knows? All right. Ranulf said, even my, and this was to do about when we were earlier on discussion about white America, even my mother, who is uncomfortable talking about race, was sympathetic to Shiloh Hendricks, especially after comparing her with Austin Metcalf's killer. That gets us back to that matter. And I think loads of people were, and this is the whole point. This is the whole point. Ranulf also said, white tribalism is inevitable. I see center-right creators like Bjorn Andreas Bull Hansen and Metatron are increasingly pushing back against anti-whiteism.
Yeah.
And that relates to the culture war stuff and how anti-whiteism is sort of is being attacked. It's still going in some ways, even though other aspects of wokery have dialed down. There's still this
driving
thing against,
They don't have, it's not as much power there anymore. I mean, it's still there, but so it's not that it's over, but the next step is, it's okay to, as I said before, it's okay now, essentially, to be anti-white, right? But there's still that, but pro-white. We're almost there. It's right there, basically. It's basically accepted, but we have a little bit
of power. Ironically, I agree. And ironically, the gatekeeper there is Tucker Carlson, as I mentioned earlier, where he's still going on this thing about race blindness.
Yeah.
It's too late. It's too late now.
Yeah, we're done. We're not doing that, Tucker, okay? That's over.
Exactly. Ranulf also said, social media has exposed the hate that non-whites have for us, with so many blacks and leftists even celebrating and justifying Irina Zarutska's murder. That's absolutely monstrous. I think I kind of shut myself off from that sort of thing, because it just makes me angry. But yeah, there's been a lot of anti-white shit on Twitter this year from Indians and Arabs,
good,
and blacks, especially from the Indians.
Let's have it. Let's do this.
Yeah.
That's just good, Yeah.
It only helps us.
Yeah, it does.
It makes our case for us.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much the Indians have discredited themselves this year. I love to see it.
Thank the gods for Jeetery. Without them, we'd be far set back.
Exactly. Kermie said, always wonderful to have Henrik. Appreciate you all. Thank you very much,
Kermie. Thank you.
Ghost Dog Man said, Charlie Kirk would have been a cross of Charlton Heston and Billy Graham as he matured. They would rather burn it all down to the ground than see us leave them. Glenn Close is boiling our bunnies. She lost. I don't know who Billy Graham is, so I don't know
what he's the that means. Evangelical TV and evangelical. Oh. Can't even speak. You know what I'm talking about? He's one of the first ones that really pushed a lot of the Zio stuff in the churches and stuff. He has some big mega church, right? That's him.
I can get
TV can't even say it. Evangelics. what they call
it? Was it televangelist?
Televangelist. That's what I'm looking at. Thank you.
But I get the point, but I think it's too late for that. I don't think Charlie Kirk would have done that, because I just don't think there's it's not happening now. I just don't see it. I mean, remember what happened with his replacement. What was his name?
Whatever his name was. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that wasn't really kind of official. There was just someone that they tried to shoehorn in there as his replacement, but that was funny.
Fresh off the production line.
Yeah, pretty much.
It was just ridiculous.
Yeah, the Zog factory.
Yeah, exactly. And then Ghost Dog Man said, thanks again, Bose and Henrik, another perennial favorite. Thank you.
Thank you.
And K. Max McDonald said, in both of your views, can Europe fight back against this demographic replacement before America does? It seems the UK can get larger street rallies, but stifles speech more. What is your view of Europe's chances? Well, we kind of talked about, there's a cat.
There's a cat. Big he was meowing, cat. Yep, a Aww. Big fluffy cat. You see his face?
Aww.
It's Izzy, 16 years old. I brought him from Sweden. Swedish cat. Aww. Genuine Swedish cat right there. Look up at the camera, Izzy. Hey, we want to see you.
Yeah.
Hey, buddy. All right.
Hello. What's his name?
Izzy. Short for Isbjörn, which means polar bear in Swedish.
Ah, right. Okay. Yep. Oh, God, that's adorable. What a lovely wee interlude there. Well, yeah, we talked about this earlier.
Yes.
But white Europe chances.
I think European countries might be able to fight. It doesn't look like it now, but I think some European countries might be eventually kind of ahead of what America is doing in some ways. I mean, I could go into a whole spiel of why. I don't have to, but short answer is there's going to be, once certain European countries, once they've crossed again, or the cup is flown, the last drop that causes the cup to flow over, the straw that breaks the camel back, whatever you say, once you get that release point and get past the bottleneck, it could go very, very quickly in some European countries, frankly. That's what I think. Will it happen? I don't know. I hope so. We're going to fight for it, but, you know, we'll see. What do you think, Wes?
Oh, I think so. I think I'm actually really optimistic about the AfD in Germany. Maybe I'm a fool but I know people will say they're, you know, lesbian and Zog and all that, but I think they're...
Which is true, but yeah.
Yeah. And yet they seem serious. That's the thing. They don't
They're a stepping stone. My point is they're a stepping stone. They're helping to normalize nominal nationalistic conservative tendencies in Germany, and that's a necessary step. That doesn't mean that they're the ones who are going to fix Germany. It doesn't mean that they're the views they're going to. It's just getting behind them. Then what does it hurt to support them with a ballot once every whatever it is, you know, a couple of years, 4 years, and see what they can do? And then from there, they weren't strong enough. Okay, next. So it's not about you investing all your time in politics or try to figure that AfD, you know, kind of thing. Just help it along, and then you go. Then they break another taboo, another bubble, which we never could have achieved 10 years ago. And in the wake of that, or even in the wake of the failure of the AfD, you have extreme potential that is going to be much stronger, right? So that's what it's about. It's just about creating opportunity and working with the flow and the stream and where the energy lies, as opposed to like, well, I'm more nationalistic than the kind of, you know, gay nationalistic party, so I'm going to just kind of try to hold them back together with the leftists or something. I mean, what is that? That doesn't do anything.
Exactly.
Right?
And it just depresses and demoralizes everyone. I mean, I'm fucking sick of this. I want to be optimistic. It's been a long slog, and I think that we should be taking opportunities for optimism when they appear, and I think there are loads of them in 2025.
Take the W when you can, but that doesn't mean you're like set or like, oh, that's it then, you know, like that's not what it means. It's just, it's important with these small, you know, moral, you know, boosts, I guess, to keep the fighting morale high. All right, we gained a little ground. Good. All right, let's next battle, you know.
Exactly. All right. Well, let's end it there. I love that Izzy showed up. That's just adorable. And he seems to have fallen asleep now, which is hilarious. Oh. That's lovely. All right. okay. Oh, there's one more super chat from President Obunga.
Ah, President Obunga. Good to see you, man.
You should definitely write a book called The Rainbow Regime. Thank you. I will. Did you guys see the video of Netanyahu commanding Western governments to defend Jews? No, I didn't. I haven't seen that. Has that been over the last few days?
Which one of the 10 of those videos? I did. I also saw the one. It was probably part of the same speech, I would assume. But he was like saying, America wouldn't like basically be nothing if it wasn't for like Jews or whatever. So I assume it's the same vein, or maybe it's in that same clip or whatever. We'll probably play it tomorrow for Flashback Friday. But this is what they do. That's how they view themselves.
Yeah. Roseanne, about a week ago, said a similar thing that America needs the Jews more than the Jews need America. I've also seen in that video that I've talked about loads of times, should the Jews leave Europe? It's on YouTube, mm-hmm. And it's three New York Jews, and they say Europe needs Jews more than Jews need Europe. They're obsessed with this idea that we need them more than they need us. And
well, and I think they should punish us then by leaving. How about that?
Absolutely.
Please go ahead. Yeah. We totally deserve it.
Exactly. I haven't seen Schindler's List enough times, so
that's
punish
right.
me.
Yes.
All right. Let's end it there. So this has been great, and I'll be back tomorrow night with the full four tomorrow night. Okay, we start with, it was going to be the Jolly Heretic, Ed Dutton, but he had to reschedule. So instead it's going to be Michael Rayners, then Dave Riley, then Sam Dixon, and then Stefan Verstappen. So that should be interesting. Oh,
He's a nice cat. He's getting old now, but he's doing pretty good. Yeah. He's 16 years old. How about that?
Yeah. I could just watch that for ages.
That is not AI generated. I promise you.
Okay.
My AI right. cat. You wouldn't even know that's what's so creepy about.
Yeah.
It's all inserted. I mean, Merry Christmas. Good Yule to you, Woz, and everyone out there watching.
Okay. Thank you very much, Henrik. And everyone else, I'll see you tomorrow night. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? The Millennial NFT is a unique animated vector graphic available for just one lucky owner. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.